Well, hi folks, welcome back to Naturally Adventurous. This is Ken and Charlie again for the second consecutive recorded episode together in the same physical location, shockingly.
Beautiful location.
Beautiful location.
Ooh. Do you want to describe where we are?
We're still in South Africa. We're co-guiding a trip for a big group of people here in South Africa, and we have made our way east from Cape Town. And we're now in what's called the Garden Route, which is a pretty lush, beautiful portion of the coast of the Indian Ocean of southern South Africa. You have some kind of lush cloud forest. And we're actually at the edge of the cloud forest on the side of a hill right now in my hotel room, looking out at this absolutely spectacular panorama of the Indian Ocean with big, sort of 3 meter tall breakers hitting the beach. Quite inspiring. But well, actually, what inspired this episode is that a couple days ago, we passed the site of one of Charlie's bigger, let's say, disasters while guiding a birding tour. And this was actually an idea that came from a friend of the podcast a while back, was some to do an episode about like disasters while guiding.
We were a little bit apprehensive about this topic because, listeners might not want to come on tours with them, but just bear in mind some of these things were not completely our fault, A, and B, we've been guiding a long time, and I think we're kind of older and wiser now than we once were.
I mean, when you do something for 15 years, it doesn't matter how good you are at it, how careful, or even how lucky, you're going to have some bad luck. So we'll tell a few stories of bad luck or whatever, but the story that inspired this, it was basically we went into this reserve called De Hoop on the coast of Cape Agulhas. And right at the entrance of De Hoop, there used to be a lodge called
Beautiful. Bush Camp.
Buchu Bush Camp,
Yeah.
which was a lovely place to stay on a birding tour
It's
until
beautiful. Beautiful.
Charlie burnt it down. Or at least that's the story I always tell. Do you want to tell the true story?
Yeah, it's a bit of a story. This was, I think, my first tour to guide in South Africa, and I was a little bit nervous. And things started going wrong almost immediately. We had our first night, and we went out for dinner to a nice restaurant. It wasn't on the ground floor, it was one up the first floor. When we'd finished our meal, there was an elderly chap. He was going on 80. He was maybe mid-70s, late 70s, and there was a set of stairs going down. It was maybe like 20 stairs. It was like a full staircase, and he tripped over and he rolled down.
Oh,
Imagine like a
jeez.
75-year-old rolling down a staircase.
Terrifying.
It was like a stuntman, and like miraculously he wasn't injured. We were like, "You okay?" And he stood up, and he was absolutely fine. I mean, it was seriously impressive. I mean, he did like three full rolls down the stairs. Anyway, so
I don't even remember hearing that part of the
now,
story.
well, I mean, because there's so many other worse bits to the story. So that happened. We needed to have a trailer. So sometimes you're in a little minibus, and you can't fit all the bags in, so you need a trailer. So we booked a trailer, and when I picked up the minibus, it didn't have a tow hitch. So we quickly had to get them to find another little minibus that did have a tow hitch. And I guess this second vehicle had a few issues. I think the battery wasn't great. And it had this quirk, like if you had the air conditioning on and you stopped the engine, it wouldn't start again.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So you had to, we only figured this out after we'd had to push the vehicle like two or three times. But we thought, okay, so you see a bird, you stop. You have to quickly remember to turn the air conditioning off and then turn the key off. Otherwise,
And
flat battery, elderly people having to push start this van. So this happened quite a few times.
for people who don't know, you do a tremendous amount of stopping and turning off the engine on a birding tour. You're just constantly, you're doing this like
Imagine.
200 times a day.
But then if you add to this that we also had a trailer. So you've got to push start a minibus with a trailer. So you've got to take the trailer off. You have to get all the elderly people to push start the minibus. and then you rev it and you kind of zoom around, kind of back up,
reattach
the trailer, and then you're off. All these,
ridiculous.
Yeah. Anyway, so I don't know how many times we did this. Maybe 10 times. We got quite quick at it in the end, and I think everybody was fitter at the end of the
crew.
Yeah, no, they were.
Go.
Anyway, so this was the first little mishap.
Second mishap,
right? Yeah.
There's a guy falling down the stairs.
Yeah, and then the third mishap, we were driving along this road towards the Duhuap Nature Reserve and the Buku Bush Camp, and it was kind of a gravel, bumpy gravel road, and we'd sort of, going quite fast, and one of the tires blew out.
Mm.
It wasn't even, it was like, poof, you're going to hear the air escaping from it. So, we pull over, just get onto a little level bit where I can change the tire, unhook the trailer. And went to get the spare tire, and the spare tire was flat.
Oh.
I hadn't checked it. This is one of the things that now I do religiously.
Rookie mistake.
Yeah,
We picked up our vans here in Cape Town, yeah. Man, we went over every piece of the jack and every tool.
You checked
tool
the jack, you checked the tools, you checked the spare
triangle
tire.
Triangle. Yeah, anyway.
But yeah. I just had blind faith that a reputable car hire company, who shall remain nameless, would have given us a spare tire that wasn't flat. But anyway, this was flat, so I would have to call the car hire companies to come and get us. And I looked at my phone, and there was no phone signal. Middle of nowhere, no phone signal. So I mean, what do you do?
It's a pretty remote area, really.
Yeah,
it's way
he goes
down
through these little stretches where there's just no. Anyway, and we were just standing around scratching my head, and we had a little bit of luck. A guy came by, South African. And he was like, "Oh, you guys okay?" And we're like, "Not really."
Not exactly.
Yeah, I said the tire's flat, and there's no spare. And he said, "Oh, no problem." And he had one of these things that fill a tire
like
with
fix a flat.
Yeah, it's like a fix a flat thing. And this was just incredibly lucky. I mean, a guy would come by with one of these and stop and offer us help like that. So that filled the tire long enough for us to get back to the closest tire place, which was maybe 45 minutes away. So we sort of got there, fixed both tires, put them back on, put the spare back on, so we're in good shape now. Hook up the trailer, start it, and then we're on the road again. So we get to this beautiful hotel called the Buku Bush Camp, just outside Duhuap Nature Reserve. And it's just set in this most beautiful, fynbos kind of moorland habitat, wild habitat. It's a beautiful wooden building with a lovely grass roof. Yeah, magical. And an open fire, which sort of, when you think about it, is maybe not the most sensible thing to have in a wooden house with a grass roof. But anyway, we sort of settled into our rooms. We came to dinner, all nice and toasty with the open fire. And they just start bringing our soup. And I think I had maybe two spoonfuls of soup. And I looked up, and there were these little embers, falling from the ceiling. And I guess some embers had gone up the chimney and then sort of fallen down and set the roof on fire. Which, of course, is not my fault, This is why it irks me when people say that the hotel that you burnt down, I was just happened to be in it at the time. But, yeah, anyway, so had to stop eating our soup, and we're kind of looking up, and there's a very small little hole kind of in the ceiling. We're sort of looking up at the stars.
Incandescent little hole.
Yeah, it was beautiful. All these little embers falling down. It was, and then...
Is this some kind of entertainment for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. It was magical. And the manageress, and she was like, and we're all looking up and thinking, oh, this isn't very good, is it? Maybe we should get a fire extinguisher. So she goes over and gets a little fire extinguisher, and we start going, psh, psh, psh. And then there's more embers still falling down, and it's getting bigger, and we go, psh, 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 and it's still growing. And by now, there's flames attached, and it's a foot wide. And now it's okay, and she's ordering all the workers, go and get more fire extinguishers from the rooms, and everybody's bringing, psh, 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 psh. And it just grows and grows, and then she's like, okay, I think everybody needs to go outside. Luckily, the rooms that we were staying in, they were all separate from the main building. They were maybe 30 feet away, 40 feet away from the main building. So we all kind of stepped back, and all the staff and all the neighbors' staff, and there was all these workers coming in, And they were like, had made a human chain of water buckets, and they're passing them up to the room.
Brigade.
Yeah, and I think I got up on the roof as well, and I started throwing water, and we're like, come on, come on. And then it quickly became apparent that this water and these fire extinguishers were not doing anything. It was like these were just window dressing. There's nothing happening here. This was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was like, no, let's get down. And the one guy up there, he refused to come down, and I'm screaming at him to get down because it's like, you know, this is turning into an inferno. And we got him down in the end, and we all just stood back and watched this whole building go up. It was like the size of a house, and the whole place just went up in flames. And the owner, this was her kind of life's work, was to make thing. And we all stood back, and then it was like, oosh. And it's still kind of spreading along the boardwalk, and it's huge. And then the embers are falling down everywhere. And we're thinking, maybe we need to take our things from our rooms. Because, right. You know, this fire is going to spread. Yeah. Catch. And we all rushed back to our rooms, packed our bags quickly, sort of moved them all. We got them to the vehicle. And one lady, she couldn't find her key to the room. And I had to sort of smash the window and crawl through this broken window. I think I might have cut my hand as well, and then I sort of smashed in the door, and then she managed to pack her stuff, and then we got all the stuff into the vehicle. So we're all safe. We've got all our stuff out, but this whole place has just gone up. It's an absolute inferno, and the lady was crying that lived there. All the workers, that was their job, you know, it was just vanished. The clients were all upset, all crying and praying, and yeah. And we went, and she actually, you know, even though she'd lost her business, she was on the phone trying to find a place for us to stay.
Wow.
And she called the nature reserve, and they had some bungalows down there. So we went down there. There was somebody who came in and cooked us dinner and stuff. And, but this whole lady's life was just ruined, you know, because of this little fire mishap. Yeah, so that was... And this was my first tour. And every time one of these little mishaps happened, I would call my boss, Keith. And then after about five or six of these phone calls, he was just almost too terrified to pick up the phone. And he was like, Charlie, you have got the worst luck of anybody I've ever met. So this was my first tour in South Africa. And I was seriously considering my choice of profession. And he did say, Charlie, it's going to get better. Don't worry about it. You know, just keep going. Don't give up now.
Good advice.
Yeah. So that was my first South Africa tour.
Actually, within a few days of the start of your first South Africa tour, right? Like,
yeah.
four days in.
Yeah, no, it was...
Wow. That's... I don't know if I ever heard the full story. That's really something, eh?
It was.
I mean, you're in this zone when you're on a tour where it's like you're comfortable and there's sort of safety margins and you're sitting... I can just imagine sitting there having your dinner and then seeing these little embers coming down. Just
yeah.
Being like, it's like a glitch in the matrix. It's like, whoa, wait a second.
If something doesn't quite compute. Yeah, you know, we're in a safe environment on a fancy tour and... Yeah.
I don't think this should be happening, but maybe this is part of the plan. Oh, wait a second.
Ooh. Wow.
That's something.
Anyway, hit me, Ken. Hit me with a disaster.
This is probably another one where we don't have time to really do it justice. But, well, this was another one we were actually together. And this was in West Papua. West Papua is a pretty, pretty wild part of the world in a lot of ways. Probably about as wild a place as is left in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
But basically, yeah, Charlie and I were guiding this trip. This was Charlie's 10-year anniversary with the tropical birding trip.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of maybe the coolest place on the tour in a lot of ways is the snow mountains. This is the central range of New Guinea. And if you know anything about the birds of New Guinea, the mountains just have, well, the whole place has just unbelievably incredible birds, like probably the most spectacularly cool, bizarre birds in the world.
Yeah.
And the mountains probably have more than their fair share of those. And there's a bunch of sort of endemic families up there in the central mountains. So it's quite a high point of a tour. So we basically flew up to this town, which is the access point called Wamena.
Wamena.
This is the local greeting of the people in that valley, the Balium Valley. They kind of wah, 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 wah. And they kind of repeat it in chorus when they get together. It's really striking. So that's why we call it Wa, Wa, Wa Mena. We made it up to Wa Mena, settle into our hotel, go out for a meal the first night. You know, everybody's all excited. And our ground agent takes me aside and is like, Ken, we have a problem. Some really bad news. And she tells me that basically there's been a guerrilla attack by the Papuan Liberation Army against the Indonesian military right in the area where we wanted to go birding. The road is completely closed by the military, and there's like thousands of Indonesian army personnel like in the area and or being airlifted as we were speaking to the area in order to try to sort of hunt down the people who did this. Yeah. So essentially it's become a war zone. Like where we wanted to bird has become a war zone overnight. It's absolutely unthinkable to go there. You know, even if we could get in there, we wouldn't want to. And B, the military is not going to let us get close to that area. Yeah. It's just completely off the table. So this is just like a punch in the gut. You know, it's like 50 incredibly awesome birds are just suddenly off the table. So I have to go to the table. I still remember kind of sidling up to the table. I'm like, wow.
Okay, folks.
Well, okay, folks. Folks. Yeah, I mean, you can't really sugarcoat it, right? You just have to say, this is the deal. And, you know, we have no choices, no options. We are really sorry about this, but we have no control over the situation. We cannot go to the normal birding places. It was particularly disastrous for one couple on the trip who were very serious family listers. They wanted to see all the bird families of the world. And there were like five families that was their only shot was up there. So suddenly pretty much the whole reason they were on this trip was just just obviated, obliterated. That was tough. They took it quite well. They, you know, they were quite understanding, but it was tough for them. Tough for everybody. Pretty disappointing. So we basically ended up, we found an alternate birding site that was
impressive that they found that. I mean,
yep,
yeah,
it was pretty interesting. We had a few really good birds there,
great birds, yeah.
So we basically, but at the same time, there was unrest in the mountains. But Wa Mena is like, it says frontier.
It's a pretty wild
town.
Place.
Yeah, you just feel like it's one of these places where like violence is always just one little trigger finger away. Like it, to put it in perspective, like the whole town is dry. You cannot buy alcohol in this town, and it's for very good reason, because it's basically right on the edge of violence all the time, and you add just a tiny bit of alcohol and it will inevitably become incredibly violent. Yeah. It's an edgy place, probably more so than anywhere else I've been. And so you're also evaluating, okay, there's trouble up in the hills, but Indonesian army is coming in. People in this town might not be too happy about what's going on. This is a place that's right on the edge of violence at the best of times. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to be hanging out here. You know, that could be sort of martial law declared or flights grounded. And so we basically, I decided we got to get out of here. So we changed our flights to the next day, pretty much the first flights we could get. So we did one morning of birding, which was pretty good. And we flew out of there. Pretty disappointing, although we were able to do some birding at a place called Nimbokrang.
We got like an extra night, didn't we?
I think we got some extra stuff. Two or three nights.
Right.
We ended up seeing this just unbelievably awesome pigeon, Victoria Crown pigeon. It's a pigeon sort of the size of, a pheasant?
Yeah.
So there was some compensation, but it was a tough situation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's different types of disasters. I mean, you kind of have like, like political things. I think we were actually in Madagascar one year when there was like a coup.
Oh yeah,
and you know we were inside the hotel. It didn't feel dangerous, but you know we saw on the news and stuff later that there was like fires and stuff out in the streets. But yeah, you've got to be. I guess, you know, like, some places where you go birding could be a little bit politically active things going on.
Sounds like a real euphemism.
Yeah.
The United States is pretty politically active.
Yeah.
Volatile.
Yeah.
Fragile.
Yeah. And I guess also there's injuries, you know. People, we've had a few tours where there's been serious injuries or health issues. Yeah.
So Charlie and I have had two different people have heart attacks during two tours that we co-guided. This has happened to us twice.
Yeah.
The one time was actually on the same West Papua tour.
Yep.
A lady had a heart attack. Not one of these sort of ones where you don't have any doubt that it's a heart attack. You know, it was kind of a mild heart attack, but she suddenly lost all energy, and it took her ages to get up a hill to see some displaying birds of paradise.
And she wasn't the kind of person to give up, you know.
No.
Stop, you know, she wasn't going to...
Very tough, very stoic. I mean, she still got up that hill. After having had a heart attack, she made it up the hill. She saw the bird of paradise.
Yeah.
But then she went back to the hotel, and she wasn't feeling well, and I went to her room, and we chatted, and she still wasn't sure what to do. And I just told her, you need to go get this checked out.
Yep.
You need to go to the hospital. And so, thankfully, she didn't argue with me on that, and she... thankfully, we had a good ground agent there who was able to assist and bring her to the hospital. And they did an EKG, and yep, sure enough, she'd had a heart attack. And and basically, within about a day and a half, I think she was on a plane home. Had to leave the tour, sadly. But looking back on that one, I was just mostly grateful that it wasn't a worse heart attack, and that we were, of all the places on that West Papua tour, that was the one where you were closest to a good hospital.
Uh-huh.
It's the biggest town in West Papua, with the best hospitals and the best connections to the rest of the world. So it really couldn't have happened at a better place.
The other one was in Namibia, of course. Another one where Ken and I were co-guiding a bunch of photographers, large group of photographers, and it was right at the beginning of the tour. I think we were still only a couple of hours. Or what was it? Oamaruru, I think we were in.
Oamaruru.
Yeah, maybe 2-3 hours from the capital. And one guy was just—he was having a pain in his chest, and there was actually a physician on the trip, and he was saying, "No, you have to go back. You have to go and get yourself checked out."
Well, I remember we drove him to. There was an old German doctor in the town.
Yes, yes.
And he was a character, you know. Yeah. He was like small town doctor. It seemed like he'd probably been there for 50 years.
Yeah.
And he basically heard the symptoms. He was like, "Yeah, you really need to go to Windhoek and have this properly checked out. I don't have an EKG." So when the local doctor said that, you know, we knew we had to get him checked out in the capital.
And then we weren't driving that trip. We had a driver, I think, in a large... We were all in one large vehicle, so I decided to go back with the guy, accompany him to Windhoek. And then, you know, we took him into the hospital there. And it was really wonderful. I mean, you wouldn't expect there to be such amazing kind of world-class hospitals there. But he ended up, you know, of course, he had travel medical insurance. And he went in there, and I stayed with him for several days while he had a stent put in. You know, it was like heart surgery, and it went very well. But then he wasn't allowed to take a regular flight home. You know, even though he'd had his stent, and he was starting to feel better, but they said no, you need to be accompanied back. And he had this air evacuation card. There was a plane that was sent from the U.S. And because it was a smaller plane, it had to do all these stops. It had to do like 6 stops, you know. It stopped in sort of Newfoundland and sort of Northern Europe somewhere, and all these stops all the way down to refuel. And there was like maybe 3 or 4, you know, there was nurses and doctors and everything on this plane. And I think the cost for that, it was almost like $200,000 to fly this plane over. But luckily he had this insurance, so... You know, when you talk about medical repatriation, it's like, oh yeah, I'd be fine, whatever. But you know, you don't want to get stuck somewhere without that kind of cover.
No.
I
mean, I think it costs like a couple hundred bucks for a typical trip That's
for decent cover. Yeah,
that's money well spent. From our experience, can say you don't want to travel without that, especially if you're a little bit older, slightly higher probability of having one of these problems. But even just trip cancellation and stuff these days with COVID and all these things in play. Yeah.
So another disaster that Ken reminded me of just before the podcast was in Madagascar. There was a, maybe an older couple, maybe like 70 or so, early 70s, but like in good shape. You know, they were good hikers and whatever. And we were hiking all these trails, steep trails, and we came back down and we got onto a flat trail. It's like a sort of stone trail. And she stood just on the edge of that, and there was like a, it was made of stones, and she, one of the stones gave way, and her legs kind of came out from under her, and she landed on the stone trail on her hip, and the hip shattered. It wasn't even just like it got dislocated; the whole thing just got shattered. This needed like reconstructive surgery, and you know, Namibia has wonderful medical care, but like Madagascar, not so much. So she was taken in extreme pain, like maybe 3 hours back to Tana.
Well, first of all, didn't she have to be carried out of the forest?
She had to be carried out, yeah. By all the guides.
Did you organize like a team of porters and guides?
Yeah, all the different, the local guides and stuff. They got people together and they made like a, and it wasn't even a real stretcher. It was like a sort of, some kind of like homemade. And then she had to be laid down in the visitor's center for a bit, and then they got like maybe an ambulance to come, and it just took forever, and she was just in absolute agony for hours, and then she was on this sort of bumpy road on this little terrible little ambulance all the way back to Tana, and she was just in a real state. But they they gave her painkillers and they made her comfortable, but when they saw what had happened, I think they did an x-ray and they realized that this, we can't really handle this in Madagascar. You've got to go somewhere else. So she was actually also air evacuated, but only as far as South Africa, which has, you know, world-class medical care. And then she stayed there for, I don't know how long. They were there for quite a while, for the whole surgery.
Yeah, was
surgery.
It 2 weeks or something?
Yeah,
3 weeks?
Maybe 2 or 3 weeks. But they were just raving. But we spoke to them later on, and they were raving about the medical care that they received. They said it was just absolutely outstanding, easily as good as the U.S., yeah, probably a fraction of the cost, of course. But yeah, that was another kind of eye-opener. And it was funny that it happened not on the sort of very steep and dangerous slopes that we've been on, but on this very, very flat, kind of innocuous-looking trail. And you just kind of, you let your guard down, I think. And often falls and things like that happen on these, on kind of like flat places.
Well, I'm thinking of another political disaster that I experienced.
Right.
This was, it actually didn't end up impacting the tour all that much, but it was pretty viscerally memorable. So this was in Ethiopia.
Oh.
And Ethiopia is definitely a bit volatile. I mean, the
powder keg. Yeah.
There's this kind of an ongoing civil war right now, and it can be lots of sort of ethnic power struggles and all kinds of things going on. And The sort of Oromic regions of mostly sort of southern Ethiopia are often, there's trouble there. Often people there are unhappy with the ruling party and so on. So that was sort of the scenario. It happened, I was in the middle of an Ethiopia trip. Everything had gone fine. I love Ethiopia. I wouldn't want this to put anybody off going there when you can. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place, but We're halfway through a tour, and we're in the Rift Valley, which is kind of in the center of Ethiopia, and we heard some news, you know, almost like rumors about, there was an incident where there was a wedding party of Oromic people, and there something happened, and they were fired upon by the military, and a bunch of people were killed, and it was this real kind of powder keg type of, you know, it was an incident that inflamed the passions, I guess. It just seemed like egregiously violent, and, you know, I don't know what the full story was, but it was the kind of thing that where people were upset in the region. But then we didn't hear anything specific about, well, what's happened or whatever, and so we continued on our itinerary. We drove up into the Bali Mountains. We're driving along the road, and I suddenly had a feeling of unease. I mean, this is something like when you guide for a long time, you start to learn to trust your kind of gut feelings.
Yeah.
I mean, you trust your gut and you get these senses of something's off. It's kind of a skill you develop. I also think you develop a skill of just foreseeing what can go wrong. Because like when you guided that first South Africa trip, you probably just had no conception of all the things that could go wrong. Yeah. And then the one after another, they did go wrong. And then in the future, you just kind of calibrate your actions for all these eventualities.
Yeah.
But so we're driving along this highway. It's actually quite a nice new Chinese built highway. Pretty decent speed. And something was off. And then what I realized is I haven't seen a car in like an hour. I haven't seen another car coming the other way.
Hmm.
It's not a heavily trafficked highway, but there should have been somebody. And right about when this feeling of unease kicked in, way off in the distance on the road, there was this blackish speckled haze. And I basically just shouted to my driver. I just said, "Stop!" He slammed on the brakes.
Right. This
is still pretty far in front of us. You know, like you can't make it out with the naked eye, but there's something obscuring the road in front of us. And I lifted my binoculars and I looked through the windshield, and suddenly at 8 times magnification, there were hundreds of people carrying farm implements rushing towards us at full speed with looks of just like maniacal anger on their faces.
Whoa.
I mean, this was just literally, it was literally a mob with pitchforks. Many of the people had pitchforks, machetes, and they were just sprinting towards us. And they just wanted to destroy something. You know, they were angry. They were protesting. They were aggrieved. I'll just never forget that binocular full, like, and then I just screamed to the driver. I just said, turn around. And, you know, because he couldn't see it, right? For him, right. It's just like, what's going on here? Yeah, you know, you might think, oh, that's a military roadblock. I was just like, go. I didn't know whether there might be people coming in from the side or behind us to block it.
Yeah.
So he pulls a Yui and we just blast off down the road.
Yeah.
We get away. We retreat to the nearest big town. We get some more information about what's going on. Apparently, just in the last couple hours, local people have put up a whole bunch of roadblocks on that highway as a kind of form of protest. We do the whole sort of south of Ethiopia in a big loop. We ended up doing the loop in reverse. And by the time we actually came back through that area, the unrest had been resolved. I remember driving the highway. This is the same highway where we'd been charged by this angry mob. And just every couple kilometers, there was the remnants of a huge barricade across the road.
Really?
Like burned out tires and stuff. But all this rubble had been moved to the sides of the road. And I was a bit disturbed to wonder, like, what kind of repression did the military employ to suppress this? Like, you know, I have a feeling it wasn't gentle. But we were able to complete the tour and even go back through that area, no problems. So to me, it was a sobering lesson about just how quickly stuff can bubble up or explode in a place that you think is peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
And Ethiopia is weird because it is remarkably peaceful. The people are like quite gentle and kind and inhospitable. In general, even when they're unhappy, it's not really directed at foreigners.
Yeah.
I don't know what would have happened if that angry mob had caught our car, but just looking at those people's faces, it was like, this was a mob, you know? It was like, even if most of the people were reasonable, there was just enough just angry, irrational people there that it probably would have ended very badly. So, yeah, this stuff happens in a hurry.
Political stuff. Oh, I've just remembered one more. This was more a kind of like a striking, causing disruptions, but we were in Argentina. And we were taking a flight from Buenos Aires up to Misiones or something like that, going up to Iguazu. And we got to the airport And then there seems to be a lot of people there, and there seems to be some sort of disruptions. And we get to the counter, and they say, "No, there's going to be what do they call it? Like some striking action." I think the airline employees are going on strike. Anyway, I was with maybe like 8 elderly Japanese people, and we were stuck in this airport with massive crowds of people for about 8 hours.
Ooh.
It was absolutely horrendous, and there's people, all the crowds are chanting, and you know, "We want to fly, we want to fly. Okay. Queremos volar, queremos volar."
And they're all counter strike.
Yeah, no, and one of the funnest things seemed to be there was some musicians, I guess, were traveling as well, and it became like a sort of huge concert venue. There was this saxophonist just breaks out his thing, and he's jumping up and down, and everybody's clapping and dancing and stuff. It was just bizarre. And I think, you know, that there's certain countries that seem to be sort of more prone to strike action than others, you know, but Argentina is certainly one of these kind of places. And what do? You know, you're supposed to be flying with a bunch of people. You've got hotel reservations from where you're arriving, you know. And then they say suddenly, your flight is delayed, it's delayed, it's delayed. And we were watching the screen the whole time saying, "Oh, delayed, another hour, another hour." And we're like, "Oh, please, please, please." And then in the end, it just says cancelled. And then you've got to get to a try and rebook or something. And you know, there's thousands of people trying to get to a desk to rebook.
Ooh.
And in the end, these people came out, all these airline employees, and everybody's booing them and shouting, "Yeah, boo, boo." And they just
"Queremos volar."
Yeah, "Queremos volar, queremos volar." It was such a weird thing. And I was on the whole, you know, on the phone to the office, like, "Oh, you know, what are we going to do? You know, can you cancel and try and rebook the flight?" And in the end, it just seemed that there was no chance that we were going to be able to fly. So I thought we could maybe try and take a bus, like an overnight bus. So I took all these. This is, you know, how I used to travel when I was backpacking. And it's not how people envisage doing a sort of nice, fancy nature tour. It's going on a public bus up for overnight. But, yeah, we managed to get bus tickets, booked them online. And then, you know, we ate dinner in the bus terminal. And then we arrived, yeah, the next morning.
Really?
And wow. Managed to get there and continue the tour. But it was a major, major disruption. And, yeah, it was something, yeah.
These are the disaster stories that are picked from sort of 30 years of
combined
experience.
Yeah.
It actually and honestly surprises me how many places you can go around the world in just total peace and comfort and security without incident. It really is. I mean,
often the worst thing that happens is, you know, your meal takes a little bit too long to come, you know, or... you're in a different type of room or something like that. You know, basically, when it comes down to it, you're gonna be fed and you're gonna have a place to stay. So,
yep,
and get from A to B.
Yep,
pretty minor inconveniences.
I mean, in terms of things that seemed disastrous that ended up not being a particularly big deal, we had a lady on a Namibia tour. She had her passport probably stolen. It disappeared one of the first nights of the tour. And this is something that people are just so fearful about, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of attention to the passports. Where are the passports? Where should we leave the passports?
They could take everything. I don't care if I lose my $10,000 camera, as long as I don't lose my passport.
Yeah. So this is just like worst fear realized. But she basically, we arranged a transfer for her to shoot back to the capital. Within 24 hours, she got a new passport from the U.S. Embassy, and yep. She rejoined the tour less than 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the absolute worst case scenario many people can imagine really wasn't that big of a deal. It was an inconvenience and it was a bit of extra cost, and which was probably covered by travel insurance. So,
yeah,
it is amazing. Things just tend to work out. I mean, even your thing about, like, the strike.
Mm.
At the time, it seems like such a pain, and
yep.
It's insurmountable, and it's like, well, you get on the bus, next morning you wake up, you're there, and
yep. Same
you
place.
Go, yeah. Carry on, go birding, and it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been a tiny number of stories of fatalities on birding tours, but when you consider the number of people who have traveled, you know, it's probably no more risky than sort of driving around on highways in the States or something.
No.
when it goes wrong, it makes for good stories.
So that's about all the stories we got time for this week. We were chatting about what to have as a natural sound, and I thought it would be fitting to take us back to the Buchu bush camp that I supposedly burnt down. But yeah, one of the cool birds in that area is called the clapperlark, the Cape clapperlark. And we actually just, we had a wonderful experience with it just in the last few days. And it's just kind of medium, fairly small brown bird, but it's got this just crazy flight display. It kind of flaps its wings very audibly up and then kind of glides back down. It does these little whistles, but it's just really audible. It's a wonderful name, the clapperlark, but it really does clap its wings very loudly. And we had one of these, like, displaying right in front of the whole group.
It's like 10 feet in front of us.
And, you know, even though it wasn't a, you know, amazingly beautiful bird, it really was one of the highlights so far of this trip. So we're going to leave you with the Cape clapperlark from South Africa. Thanks for joining us again. Special thanks to our patrons. We'll be sending you a bonus episode soon. If you're interested in supporting the show, then yeah, check us out on patreon.com on the link in the episode description. And yeah, we will see you all next week.